Good morning. Welcome to the joint Judiciary Committee meetings of the Senate and the House. Madam Chair, could you introduce your members this morning?
I would. Good morning. We have Representative Dahlstrom, Guerra, Cott, and myself, McGuire.
And on the Senate side, I have Senator French here, I have Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins. Our other members will be joining us shortly, and a couple of yours are also on the way. We are meeting together today, and it's always a pleasure to meet with the House Judiciary Committee. We don't do it often enough. But we're meeting today for the opportunity to conduct a hearing prior to determining whether or not we're going to forward the name of my good friend Dave Marquez to be the Attorney General of the State of Alaska. Morning, Mr. Marquez.
Good morning, Chairman Seekins.
We're glad to have you here this morning. Just for the record, Mr. Marquez is the Attorney General, but after we confirm, he will be my son's employer. So I have a conflict. Well, my wife has a conflict of interest. She wants her boy to get a raise in pay, Mr. Marquez. So. I've known Dave for a long time. We started to get to know each other when we were on the Executive Committee of the State Chamber of Commerce together, back when he was in the private sector. And so I just want everybody to know that he's been a longtime friend of mine, and I have a great admiration for his ability and skills and for the work that we've done together already. Mr. Marquez, if you would do us the pleasure, would you tell us why in the world you want this job?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to you and Chair McGuire for conducting this hearing today and making it joint. I'm very honored to be selected as the nominee for Attorney General. It's a great opportunity to serve the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska has very much blessed myself and my family. My wife and three kids were all born in Alaska, and I'm eager to pay back the state of Alaska, if you will, through public service, and being the Attorney General magnifies that opportunity. And I'm pledged to work hard and do my best for the state of Alaska.
Questions from the members? And I want to, for the record, Senator Terrio has joined us. Representative Anderson has also joined us.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Huggins.
Comment. I would be remiss if, looking through Mr. Marquez's bio, I'd like to note that in 1968 through 1970, he was a veteran. Served in Vietnam, and probably in the business of being a lawyer, probably in great minority. And for that, in our country, I say thank you very much for what you did.
Thank you, Senator Huggins.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I wanted to ask how you think your experience in corporate law, and like you work with ARCO, I read in your resume, and we've worked together back when you were in that capacity, how that will aid and help you in your new capacity.
Well, it might be helpful if I reviewed that portion of my experience, if I could have the indulgence of Senator Seekins and Representative McGuire.
Please go ahead.
I started my legal career what now seems back at the dawn of time in a private law firm, and got experience in administrative law and labor law and commercial transactions and litigation. And joined ARCO, Alaska, the subsidiary of the larger corporation Atlantic Richfield Company, in Anchorage in 1977. I started out as a staff lawyer doing work for the Prudhoe Bay Unit organization and other departments, and really got my start in representing departments and giving advice to the heads of departments that were trying to advance ARCO's development of its oil and gas resources. And I think that was a valuable experience because I started out as a staff lawyer and understand the burdens and the importance of good staff work. I moved gradually into more responsibility within ARCO's legal department, and then had the opportunity to begin managing lawyers and supervising lawyers and being more responsible for the legal work that was being done by the law department. Back in the 1900s and the early 1990s, I became general counsel of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, the company that operates the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And this was the first opportunity for me to serve as a member of an executive team, reporting directly to the president and leading an entire department of law. I managed a significant litigation that was facing Alyeska at the time. And this provided me with, I think, directly relative experience, because as Attorney General, I will be providing legal advice to the Chief Executive of the state, the governor, and his cabinet, and bearing ultimate accountability and responsibility for managing the lawsuits and other legal affairs of the state. I came back to ARCO, Alaska, after my service as General Counsel Alyeska, to become Vice President of External Affairs and Environment, Health, and Safety for ARCO, Alaska. During that time, I was responsible for media and government and community relations and safety programs, training programs in environmental areas and safety areas. And during that time, I had the opportunity to work on the Alaska Stranded Gas Development Act as it was introduced and worked its way through the legislature, and worked on a number of task forces as we worked on that legislation before the legislature. I then became head counsel for ARCO Alaska, and again had an experience like I had at Alyeska, in which I was equivalent to a cabinet member serving the chief executive, the governor, in this case serving the president of ARCO Alaska, and being a member of his executive team. So I think that the corporate experience that I've had is directly relevant. It's been mostly in the natural resources area, but has also involved managing departments of law and other organizations, and has involved being responsible for significant litigation. And so I think that that kind of experience is directly relevant to the kind of jobs that I'll be doing as general counsel, as attorney general, excuse me.
Senator Guest has joined us as well this morning. Other questions for Representative Guerra?
Mr. Chair, and just so you know, feel free to shift to another questioner if they've got a question in between the ones that I have. I have a few questions. I just want to make sure I'm comforted that that this will be a good appointment, and so if you'll.
We'll allow you a certain amount of leeway, Representative Garrett. Go ahead.
Thank you.
And comfort.
And comfort.
Mr. Marcus, thanks for coming. You come with a big plus, which is the people who've worked with you have said good things about you, and I think that's important. So
thank you.
I do have some questions, and I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't ask them, and there'll be some of the ones we talked about yesterday. My biggest question is this, and I think once you represent to me that what you did in the office yesterday, I'll probably be okay with this. One of your more recent private sector jobs was as counsel and an executive for Phillips, which is now ConocoPhillips. They're involved as one of the three applicants for probably the largest, perhaps the largest project in Alaska history. And there's a debate among many of us as to who the, maybe which company should be building the gas pipeline. So how would you address for us this concern? As a counsel, as an attorney for somebody, you have a legal obligation to uphold their best interests. Then when you leave, that duty is somewhat over. But you had that duty for Phillips, which is now part of Conoco. They're applying to build a gas pipeline. They're one of three competing groups that are applying to build a gas pipeline. How would you respond to any concern whether or not you can objectively evaluate the applications of other people who are competing with ConocoPhillips and the producers?
That's a very fair question, and I'm sure one that concerns many Alaskans. Representative Guerra, and it's a question that the public has to be satisfied with before they can place their trust in the Attorney General. My answer would be in several parts. First of all, as I mentioned before, I've lived in the state for almost 32 years, and my wife and my three children were born here. I have a great love for and a real devotion to the state of Alaska. And I think that love and that sense of obligation is probably the primary motivator for me in my work as Attorney General and overrides any past associations that I might have. As you mentioned, as a lawyer, I have an ethical duty to represent my client to the utmost of my ability. And I've been trained to do that, and I've had a lot of experience in doing that. And now I'm very honored that my client is the state of Alaska, as it has been for the last two or three years. And I'm going to pledge, as it is my ethical duty to do so, to fully represent the state of Alaska to the utmost of my ability. There is concern about my past employment. Some people have told me that they're concerned that I'm an oil industry employee. I think that's a little bit of a misnomer, one that perhaps people have this view of the oil industry as a huge monolith, but my experience has been that most of my career I worked for ARCO, and as a lawyer for ARCO, I was an employee of one company in an extremely competitive industry. And I spent my career with ARCO negotiating with, litigating, and arbitrating against, and quite frankly, trying to extract value for my client from Exxon and BP. And I never represented BP or Exxon, and in fact, spent my career battling them. And so I don't have loyalties to BP and Exxon. In fact, I have a lot of experience in dealing with both of those companies on the other side of the table. That doesn't say that I don't respect the contribution that those companies have made to the economy of Alaska and the individuals that I've negotiated with and had other dealings with that work for those companies. But certainly my experience has been on the other side of the table. I worked briefly for Phillips. By briefly, I mean somewhere between a year and 2 years when BP purchased ARCO. ARCO no longer exists. It's now been subsumed into British Petroleum. And as part of that transaction, the FTC required that BP shed its ARCO Alaska assets, and Phillips acquired those assets. And so for a time after the merger, I worked for Phillips. And then after I left, Phillips was merged with Conoco. I've never had any association with Conoco. I really don't know that company at all. And I think there are now in the greater ConocoPhillips far more Conoco and other Heritage employees then there are Phillips employees, very few whom I ever got to know. And throughout my career with ARCO, Phillips was another company that was always on the other side of the table from me. So I feel that my experience really, rather than maybe prohibiting me from functioning in this role, really facilitates it because I have had a tremendous amount of experience on the other side of the table from them. I also think that the committee has to keep in mind that in a resource state, one would expect that former employees of those of resource companies would come to work for the state, and I would think that the state would welcome that participation because those employees would bring not only knowledge about the development of resources, but also would bring knowledge about those particular companies and how they might act and how they might think and how they might plan, et cetera. I've had the pleasure in serving very recently now on the gas cabinet of working with Tom Irwin, the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, who you might describe as an oil industry employee, but I'm sure he feels the same way I do, that he was the employee of a company in a very competitive mining industry.
A mining industry member.
Right. And, you know, I've had the pleasure of working with Mark Myers, who I worked with at ARCO for many years and who's now the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. I have the utmost respect for both of those people, and I've enjoyed working with them, and I've never seen the slightest hint that they bear any favorable bias toward those companies over and above their obligations to the state. And I expect to comport myself in the same way. My client will be Alaska, the state of Alaska. And again, I pledge myself to represent that state to the utmost of my ability.
In that regard, Mr. Marquez, when did you leave employment with the oil companies?
It would have been December of 2001.
Have you remained on or received any kind of retainer from the oil companies since that time?
No, I haven't.
Thank you.
May I continue?
Representative Garrett, go ahead.
Thank you. And so just going back to the three pending gas pipeline applications, all I really want to hear is is whether or not you feel like you have any leaning towards any of the three applicants, and your answer will probably satisfy me. Do you have any leaning in favor of the producer's application, the Conoco application, or the TransCanada, or the Development Authority applications as Attorney General?
The short answer is no. We are still in negotiations in various stages with the three applicants, and part of my job will be to evaluate those applications and the plans behind them and the fiscal terms and non-fiscal terms that they will be proposing. And I'm going to withhold judgment until the gas cabinet is ready to fully evaluate the three and make a comparison of the three in terms of what the benefits are to the state and what terms might be requested of the state in terms of fiscal stability. And I'm not going to have a bias until I've had the opportunity to fully examine an analysis of those three proposals. And at this point, we're not ready for that. I also might describe a little bit that my role is as a member of the gas cabinet, which is made up of the Department of Revenue, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Law, along with the Chief of Staff and some of the Governor's staff. And that role is a member of a team. No member of the team has any decisional authority. We are all there to advise the governor and provide analysis from the legal consequences to the economic consequences. The governor, of course, will make the ultimate decision and then submit it to the legislature, where there will be the opportunity for a full public examination of any proposed contract. I'm a member of a team, and I expect to bring my expertise to the examination of all three of the applications.
Go ahead, Representative Guerra.
If anybody else wants to jump in, just let me know. I've got two other areas that I just want to ask questions on. One, Ms. Marcus, one of the more important pieces of litigation and that the department is working on right now is many of us believe that the pipeline owners are overcharging for transportation of our oil. And if that's the case, that's a deterrent to development by smaller companies that can't afford to get their oil in. The state has taken the position that might be the case, that there is an overcharge in current litigation, and that's litigation that the state intends to continue to pursue.
Yes, yes, and I have to be careful here because we are still bound by an agreement called the TEPS Tariff Settlement Methodology Agreement, and that has limited the state's ability to challenge the tariffs. And my predecessor initiated efforts to try to renegotiate earlier than the expiration of that agreement, a new agreement. And those efforts have not been fruitful to date. But the TEP Settlement Methodology Agreement does allow the state to challenge tariffs if they are discriminatory. And we have initiated that action before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and will be challenging the tariffs that were filed by the carriers before FERC on the grounds that they are discriminatory. And we are hopeful that we'll be successful in that case, and we're hopeful that it will result in lower tariffs, because I agree with you. Lower tariffs will promote further exploration and further development on the North Slope. I will say that there had been some settlement discussions in that context. They haven't proved fruitful, and I've directed our lawyers that are directly working on that case to abandon those efforts and proceed at full speed with the litigation. I say at full speed. Sometimes the procedures before FERC are slow, but we will pursue them very vigorously.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to go to a testify before another committee, but I would just like to say recently I read a bestseller called Blink, and it was about how people like us make instantaneous decisions on things, people, and values. And when I met Mr. Marquez, my inclination 100% was this is a good person doing a great job for the state. And that was a couple months ago. And over time of having and working with you before the committee and talking about various legal aspects for the state, you have just reinforced that for me throughout the practice of that. And if I'm here for the vote for confirmation, I will be a yes.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Garrett, do you want to continue, or are there questions? Other questions are on a related topic from other members? Seeing none, Representative Garrett, continue.
The only other area I have some concern about, and it's not with you at all, it has to do with, I think, the way the Attorney General's office has been conducted the last few years. I've worked both under Attorney General Doug Bailey and Attorney General Charlie Cole, both Republicans, both fostered an atmosphere at the Attorney General that was quite nonpartisan. You had your job to do, and nobody sort of asked the employees there what their politics were, cared what their politics were. I had some concern a few years ago when two sort of high-profile Democrats, Joe McKinnon, who used to be a Democratic legislator, was fired. Ron Zobel, who had run as a Democrat for office, was fired very shortly after the last administration came in. And I guess I just want to—I want your views on whether or not it's appropriate to have any sort of political litmus test for employees at the Attorney General's office, or even whether it's appropriate at all to consider their politics at all in deciding whether or not they should work for the Department of Law or be retained by the Department of Law.
Well, certainly, utmost in evaluation of any attorney service with the Department of Law will be the skills and the dedication. And the experience that they bring to the job. But I also think that it's important for an attorney general to lead a team that is going to provide support to any administration. And I think that one could come to expect, just as one would expect in a corporation, that the president of a corporation is going to surround him or herself with members of the team that they think is going to be the most effective in advancing the agenda of the executive. I would expect that the governor would expect his department heads also to construct a Department of Law team and a Department of Natural Resources team, et cetera, with people that are going to be most effective in advancing the goals of the governor. So while I think that absolutely important are the skills and the experience that a lawyer brings, I think one would expect that in any change of administration, there would be changing out of team members to ensure that the team can function effectively for the chief executive, the governor.
Any other questions? Go ahead, Representative Guerra.
I guess I'm not following that 100% closely. Certainly, you would want an assistant attorney generals to do what they're asked to do, and if it has to do with a particular issue the governor feels important, they should work on that issue the way the governor asks. But what about, an assistant attorney general's party affiliation or who they donate to? Is that relevant at all? And is that going to be relevant at all in your determination whether or not to retain or hire people, their party affiliation or who they donate to, things like that?
I think it's going to have some relevance. I think that a person's political affiliation is important in the context of building a team that's one can trust, one can work with, and one can have the surety that as much as possible they're going to follow the leadership of the team leader. And the cabinet members are our political appointees, and one would expect that the cabinet members would want to surround himself or herself with members that they felt that they could trust. So I would expect that some of those factors would be considered. Are they absolutely overruling? No. Was there a huge effort to look at everybody's background and political affiliations and a witch hunt? No. But one would expect that in any change of administration there would be a few, and there were just a few in the Department of Law where some people were asked to leave, which is the prerogative of any cabinet member.
Chair McGuire.
You know, I think on that point, what makes up a political affiliation is a set of values and philosophies about the way things should work in that person's opinion. It's a very personal set of values and philosophies. Some end up putting an R or a D next to it, some don't. But on that point, I think a great example is in the criminal arena. Let's say, for example, that you didn't have a Susan Parks. You had somebody that viewed the criminal laws exactly opposite of the way that Susan Parks viewed them. And yet you have a governor who has come in with a directive of saying, we want to be tougher on criminals, we want to go back and re-examine some of our sentencing statutes to see whether or not we're handing out appropriate penalties in certain areas of the law. And in trying to do your job as a political appointee to this governor with that agenda, I think it would be very difficult to have a staff in the position that Susan's in that had a different set of values. I mean, that's one place where you could see an example of that.
Representative Guerra, if it's any comfort to you for the remainder of my term, it's not my intention to engage in any sort of political witch hunt. I'm very pleased with the team that I'm going to be leading. I'm very impressed. While I was section head of the legislation regulation section and as the legislative liaison, I was very fortunate to have that job because it allowed me, probably more than any other job one would have for a couple of years with the Department of Law, to get to know a large number of the attorneys that work in the Department of Law. And I have been extremely impressed with their expertise, their experience, their professionalism, their high standards of conduct, their work ethic, and their devotion to state service. So as far as the Department of Law team, on both the criminal and the civil side, I'm very impressed with the quality of the lawyers that are working.
So, Mr. Marcus, though I could understand, I appreciate your forthrightness on this, because I would assume that if you found that there was an employee in the Department of Law whose political affiliation caused them to be at odds with the objectives of the department, that you wouldn't tolerate that.
That's correct. I mean, it isn't so much, that's a good point, Chair Seekins. It isn't so much a political affiliation per se. There may be a number of people that have either participated in the Democratic in the Democratic Party or contributed to the Democratic Party within the Department of Law. I'm not informed of that, but what's important is whether or not they'll be able to be good team members.
Thank you. Senator French first, and then we'll go back to Representative Guerra.
Your last comment gives me some I appreciate the last comment, but I guess we need to go back and revisit this a little bit. Part of your analysis, part of your explaining to us how you can separate yourself from the oil industry was your reminding us that every lawyer has an ethical duty to represent his or her client to the utmost of their ability. That is, when you go to court, you're behind that client 100%. But there's a flip side to that idea, and the flip side is that when you walk out of court and when you go home, it's no longer your client. If you're not in court pressing the matter, if you're not at work pressing the matter, then you may, and you're free to believe something perhaps even contrary to what your client believed. That's how you can sit here today, tell us, I can be independent of the oil industry. I was their lawyer for a long time. But once I'm no longer their client, I've got a new client, and that's the Department of Law, or the governor, the people of the state of Alaska. And I would urge that every other lawyer in the Department of Law be given that same freedom, that they be judged solely on what they do when they're on the clock for the Department of Law. They be judged solely by the briefs they file, and the arguments they make, and the hard work they put in. And if they go home and want to wave signs for a Democrat, or wave signs for a Republican, or wave signs for a Libertarian, that that not be any part of the analysis that they get when it comes to measuring their job.
We'll get Max in here for now.
Certainly they have a constitutional right to express themselves in that manner, Senator French. And I think that, you know, it's important to keep in mind that their performance on the job is absolutely critical. But there are also times when I would expect that some person's partisanship would be brought into the office and could affect their performance on the job, and that's what would be important.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Marquez. I guess this area does cause me a fair amount of concern, only because I mean, I think it was appropriate the way I was brought through the Department of Law. And the two attorney generals I worked for were both Republicans. I'm still friends with both of them. They never cared what my politics were as long as I did my job when I was at work. Those are two separate questions. And as long as I did what I was asked at work and represented my client as vigorously as possible, nobody cared that when I went home, I disagreed with my superiors and had different politics than them. And I guess I want to ask you if you'll draw a bright line there. If an employee does their work and represents the state and represents the administration's goals when they're asked to, strongly and well, is it going to matter at all that they're not registered with the same party as the governor, or is it going to matter at all whether or not they donated to somebody the governor didn't like? Because there is a fear at the Department of Law right now that people aren't able to participate in the political process in a way that maybe their superiors wouldn't approve of. And so that's one question. And two, would you clearly tell me that you'll never be concerned about who somebody donates to or who somebody campaigns for outside of work?
Well, I'll be concerned about is their performance on the job, and to the extent that their partisanship interferes with their ability to fully represent the state of Alaska under the Murkowski administration, that will raise concerns. Their partisan activities outside the office, as long as it doesn't affect their performance, are not relevant. And I would say that in the time that I've been associated with the Department of Law, the employees have been very professional and hardworking and have worked hard for the agenda of the governor.
And Mr. Marquez, in that regard, I know you've supervised a lot of people in your past career, and I know that in my own business, I have people who are of different political persuasion than I am, which I don't have any particular problem with what they do after they go home at night, unless it carries forward into their daytime relationships with their fellow employees. And if I start getting a clash in the workplace because of activities that take place after work, that can affect the performance of my employees. So I would expect that in the evaluation of a person's performance, you would also be looking at how they interact with the rest of their fellow employees while they're on the job, and what portions of their after work activities have an effect there, and counsel those that may be causing a problem, and and have other disciplinary actions for those who cause a problem even within the ranks. I would imagine you'd do that. I'm not asking for a commitment. I'm comfortable with the fact, knowing you, that you'll give each person, you know, proper consideration and make good judgments on that regard. I'm not asking you. It gives me some great comfort to know that you will not tolerate an enemy in the camp and that causes a problem in the camp. But at the same time, I think you'll give everybody their opportunity to do their job.
Thank you, Senator.
Any other questions? Senator Terrio?
Yes, Mr. Marcus, you and I spoke the other day about one of the things that's probably new on your plate, and that is dealing with tribal sovereignty issues, Indian country issues that the state finds itself thrust into due to actions of some of the native entities in the state and congressional action. I've got a couple things here, and this maybe highlights part of the problem here. I was contacted recently by a dentist in the state, somebody with the state dental board, concerning state versus federal jurisdiction of dental practitioners in the state of Alaska. And under the Indian Health Service, they're allowing dental activities to be performed in the state by unlicensed persons who are claiming to be exempt from state or state standards and laws. The program sends high school graduates to a two-year program in New Zealand for training in dental procedures, and then once back, certifies that they're legally able to practice in the state of Alaska without any state licensure or parameters under any parameters of the state dental board. And I'm just wondering how you see yourself interacting on those state-federal issues with regards to jurisdiction, and whether that's an area that you've got people specifically in the department working on, or it's an area that you are going to have to take the lead on. And the previous AG had quite a bit of experience personally in that. And so I'm just wondering how you see that void being filled.
Thank you, Senator Terrio. Through the chair, there are a number of lawyers within the Department of Law who have had a long experience in what might be described as Indian law, while I don't personally have that experience and expertise, I will, as of course the Attorney General, be responsible for that work. I'm not familiar with the particular incident that you gave, but I know that the Governor generally, particularly vis-a-vis the federal government, is a strong proponent of states' rights. This week we have brought suit against the United States over RS-2477 trails, and we are engaged in other actions against the federal government. So vis-a-vis the federal government, the governor certainly is a very strong proponent of states' rights, as am I, and we will be looking at every opportunity to make sure that our ability to being an effective state government is not thwarted by the unnecessary federal intervention. So it's an area that I'm looking forward to learning a lot more about, but one that I'm not particularly familiar with right now.
Senator Terrio, go ahead.
Well, one of the things when I stepped into the presidency 3 years ago, Senator Halford coached me on looking after the issue of tribal sovereignty and the struggle that's going on right now between the state and the federal government over the tribal sovereignty issue. And the concern that he had, and I think partially due to his own circumstances where his children are of Alaska Native heritage, I think the concern that he had is that under a claim of tribal sovereignty, and the state has litigated this or entered into litigation on this matter a couple of times, that if there is tribal sovereignty and sovereign tribes claiming that they don't exist or are not don't have to exist under the rule of Alaska law and the Alaska Constitution, that therefore citizens that receive services from those entities are are not afforded all the protections that our state constitution and state laws afford the rest of the citizenry. And that the downside of that movement is that group of citizens are treated as less citizens under the state constitution. And I'm wondering if you've had any personal interaction on that, discussions with the governor on the state's position, things of that nature.
Senator, through the chairs, I have not, but I just expressed some general guiding principles. I know that tribal sovereignty really is a matter of federal law, and so the federal courts and the federal Congress determine what is Indian land and issues of tribal sovereignty. Where appropriate, I would expect very strongly to advocate for the state's sovereignty, and I would expect that we will, when appropriate, take those actions and continue to advocate, as we have in the past, for the protection of all citizens of Alaska and their constitutional rights under both the Alaska Constitution and the United States Constitution. Would hope that this is not a divisive issue. I would hope that I can serve all Alaskans, no matter what their background and their heritage. And I think that it's important for us to look for ways to communicate on this issue and to work together on this issue. And I'll pledge myself to that also.
Senator Terrio.
Well, as the top legal advisor to the governor, right? I think what you said, and maybe you want to just clarify it, that you would be looking for any possible erosion of state control over issues in the state, erosion of constitutional protections for citizens in the state, erosion of even though you represent work on for the executive branch. But if there is sovereignty, then the legislature's powers to pass laws dealing with how the citizens are to be treated or protections that are afforded to the citizens is lessened. And I would hope that you would be constantly looking for that type of erosion and advising the governor to push back and protect the state's powers. There is a state federal rural justice commission that's been meeting all winter long. It was set up by the Congress, and the commission is due to present its recommendations to the Congress and the legislature later this summer. And though the commission has not yet voted on recommendations, it has been suggested by a number of their members that the Congress actually designate all ANCSA corporate land as Indian country in the state of Alaska. Of course, we have litigated in the Vinatai case and won a unanimous Supreme Court case that Indian country does not exist in the state of Alaska, but I anticipate that a recommendation that the Congress take that action to create Indian country throughout the state will be forthcoming from that commission, and I'm wondering what your position would be on that.
Well, that would be a large departure from current law. As you say, in the Vinatai case, the United States Supreme Court determined that under ANCSA, there isn't Indian land in Alaska, other than in perhaps one of the reservations here in southeast. So it would require Congress to amend the Indian country definition in federal law. It would require an overturning of the Supreme Court case and the Vinatai case. I think it would be against the clear intent of Congress in forming ANCSA, which was an experiment to move away from the traditional ways of dealing with tribal matters and to try to create a new system of empowering Native Americans. And I think that we all would agree that Native corporations have contributed greatly to both our culture and to our economy in providing jobs and contribution to our economy through the development of their land and the development of their resources, but it would be quite a departure from ANCSA to declare that those corporation lands are Indian land. And I would expect that the administration and the legislature will be very interested in this commission report and will, through their various avenues, comment vigorously before the Congress about what is really in the best interest of all Alaskans.
Mr. Chairman.
That's Senator.
You mentioned that the issue of sovereignty is really an issue for the Congress to decide. My conversations with our congressional delegation members has been that they have not done anything, in their view, that have created sovereign powers in the state of Alaska. However, that's been muddied, that issue's been muddied, by the actions of the past governor with the, I think it was the Millennium Plan, which I, my own personal view was just pretty much an action to curry favor for the upcoming election, trying to indicate that there was an acceptance or extension of power where the state government had no right to extend power. And going back to the actions of a individual in the Department of Interior on whether the action to allow Native entities in the state of Alaska to act as sovereigns for the right of accepting and expending federal grant monies, that's now being portrayed as, well, no, that was the granting of those federal sovereign powers, you know, on everything. And unlike the Venati case, where we were able to take the Indian country actually right up to the Supreme Court to get an answer, we have not been successful in getting that kind of clarification on what the federal law says with regards to sovereign powers. And in fact, it looks like when there is a conflict that looks like it can go into the federal court system and eventually up to the Supreme Court, then actions are taken to settle that case so that we never get that clarity. So I think, you know, there's a lot of sort of murkiness on the issue of the sovereign powers. And I believe there is going to be an attempt to get the Indian country back on the table for discussion. And I would hope on behalf of the citizens in the state that you would see the erosion of the power of law, the protections of the state constitution, if either of those fronts really move forward and would really push back on behalf of the citizens.
Same subject, anyone? Other subject? Senator Guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Marquez, for coming. It's my experience that everyone deals with their conflicts of interest differently. Can you share with us kind of your personal philosophy of how you're going to approach any conflicts of interest that you may have as Attorney General?
Well, I think that it's absolutely important for the people of the state of Alaska to have confidence in their Attorney General and that the Attorney General is representing properly and completely the interests of the state of Alaska. I think that, you know, there has been a lot of interest in this area because of recent events, and I understand the strong desire of people to seek clarification, particularly in the ethics law arena, and I think that that could be very important, and I will pledge my department's assistance in any efforts to provide clarity to the ethics law. Ultimately, of course, one can't legislate ethics or morality or obedience to the law. That's always an individual matter. But I know that there's a feeling that the ethics laws could be approved, perhaps not only in the as it applies to the executive branch, but to the legislative branch. If so, we'll stand ready to work very closely with the legislature on any improvements. My personal view would be to move slowly. Because a quick solution could have unintended consequences. It can be a difficult area, and creating bright lines sometimes doesn't give enough flexibility, and too much flexibility then creates gray areas where there's legitimate dispute about the propriety of the behaviors of public officials. So I would advise that you move slowly in that, but deliberately in that arena, and we'll be glad to help you.
Senator French.
Thank you. On that topic, I agree we should be careful and we should be
cautious and we should move slowly, but I think we need to move. And one area, I mean, the events involving your predecessor brought to light for many members of the public that there are deficiencies in the Executive Act, ethics laws, or executive branch ethics laws, sorry. And what we haven't seen is any proposal from the Department of Law or from folks that work under you, that many of the experts, in how we can make that better. I've supplied my answer. I think you just draw a bright line at a certain dollar figure so everybody knows this side's wrong and this side's okay. And I'd be interested in knowing or hearing whether you have any specific view of where the dollar value should be set, where the threshold should be set, and I'd also be interested in knowing whether any of the attorneys who will soon be under your supervision are working specifically on this matter.
Thank you, Senator French, for the chairs. I think the governor forwarded some months ago now Attorney Bundy's recommendations and asked the legislature to consider those. We haven't been in the Department of Law. We have informally long examined the Ethics Act and looked for ways to improve it. And in that spirit, I certainly would pledge the support of the Department of Law in your efforts to improve the Ethics Act. I don't think that there are any present plans right now to introduce legislation from the administration on ethics, but I think the administration is awaiting action on the bills or new bills from the legislature, and will work closely through the Department of Law in improving ethics. We've got lawyers that are very experienced in the ethics arena.
If I could interrupt for just one moment. I have to leave to go to another bill. I'm going to turn the gavel over to the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and we will hold our motion until such time as all members are present. But if I could help answer that, I've been working extensively on both ethics laws and for the Administrative Ethics Act or the Executive Ethics Act and legislative, and I haven't been consulting with members of the Attorney General staff. So that they haven't provided me with any input at this point in time. Thank you. Excuse me.
Questions? Further questions?
Just to follow up.
French?
One of the simpler sort of thresholds, or one of the sort of the two numbers you hear bandied about in the building are a $5,000 threshold and a $10,000 threshold. Do you have a view on this?
I don't. I don't think that there really probably is much difference between a $10,000 threshold and a $5,000 threshold for people that make investments. I think any bright line you draw raises some practical problems. For example, if somebody owns $9,000 of Exxon stock on a given day, depending on the market, it could be $11,000 one day, $15,000 another day, and $5,000 the next. So I think as you deal with that bright line, you have to give some guidance to people as to what their responsibilities are to monitor their investments, to make sure that just because on any given day a stock might go over the threshold, that isn't necessarily destroy their safe harbor in being below the threshold. So there are some sort of practical issues that could be addressed in terms of requirements for monitoring and how often one has to check. Another issue I think that needs to be considered by the legislature are people's interests in mutual funds. I'm sure there are many state employees who have worked for the state for a long time that through their various benefits with the state may now own significant interests in mutual funds, and whether what their obligations would be with regard to those mutual funds and the stocks that those mutual funds would hold, and whether that would be a problem or not be a problem, and whether that is a different threshold or a different issue entirely. I just say all that to say that I support the desire of the legislature and the public to have some clear guidelines. I just think that the issue has to be thoroughly worked so that people will understand clearly what their obligations are under the statute, and gray areas will be minimized.
Senator French?
Last question on this subject. Would many of these problems be avoided if top administration officials with their assets and their trust upon joining the administration.
I think that's appropriate in many instances. I think you'd have to look at the nature of the investments, whether all the investments are necessary to be in a blind trust. Some interest that one holds might be non-discretionary and run by money managers that don't consult, or in fact, the agreement may be for them not to consult. So I think that that could be appropriate, though, particularly if a high official owns a lot of stock in a smaller company. I think the issues are more exaggerated with smaller companies where a stock ownership could be more of an influence than, say, generally investing in the top 500 of the Fortune 500. I think that it's also important that you realize that some of the practicalities. I understand that sometimes it's difficult to place things in a blind trust because sometimes there are not people that want to take on a blind trust unless it's a significant amount of money, and then are worried about their possible liability if during the period of the blind trust they might be susceptible to a claim that they mismanaged the money. Those are practical problems that can be worked through, but I do believe that there are appropriate circumstances for a high level executive to place their funds in a blind trust. You know, there's always going to be the hard balancing for the legislature in devising these laws to balance, as we always have in the Ethics Act, the desire to recruit talented and experienced people who have lives separate from government, and perhaps are entering government service like myself later in life, and your desire to attract those kind of people, and the other side of it, wanting those people to earn and have the public trust. So that's the reason why I think you ought to work deliberately on this matter. And again, we'll give you whatever support you do. We have some real experts in the ethics law.
Thank you. Mr. Marquez, let me just go back to see if I can get a bright line yes or no answer if possible. Just on this issue of people's political activity. It's very important to me that government not tell people how to think, that government not tell people which candidates to support, that government not tell people which parties to support, that government respect a person's, a citizen's right to think the way they want to think outside of work. And so just on this one issue, would you agree with me that it would be inappropriate in making any personnel decisions, hiring, firing, discipline, it would be inappropriate for the Department of Law to take a look at an applicant's or an assistant attorney general's donation records? Those records are online, they're available. And I just want to, can you say yes or no whether it would be inappropriate for the Department of Law to ever take a look at somebody's personal political donation records?
I'm going to be very straightforward about this. I don't think that it's inappropriate for an employer in government to look at a person's complete background. Again, I would reiterate that what's important and what's controlling is the person's behavior on the job, and it is very important to respect citizens' rights to participate in the public political arena and to exercise their constitutional rights in that area. But I do think that it's also important to make sure that the person is going to function on the job, and that's what's important is their job performance.
Representative Guerra, and wrap up on the subject.
Unless I'm wrong, I interpret your answer to mean that you might look at somebody's political donation record. So tell me if I'm wrong about that, because that really concerns me. Would you agree with this statement, that if somebody performs well and as requested at work, it's not relevant what their politics are outside of work and who they donate to outside of work?
The question's been asked and answered literally in three different ways.
And Madam Chair, the Attorney General elect or appointed here. I don't think he said that. I mean, he can certainly answer, but
I'm asking a question, though.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it's an appropriate question.
Fair enough, and I'll let this be the last in the line of questioning. However, I think you would agree that you've asked the same question in about three different ways. So this is your final opportunity to clear up anything you don't think is clear. I think you've been very clear. But to the extent that others don't.
And Chair, let me just make sure I get the question clear to him. So tell me if you agree with this statement, that if somebody at the Department of Law performs their job well, does the work that they're requested by their superiors, does it well, it should be irrelevant who they donate to outside of work, what their politics are outside of work.
I don't think you can draw that clear line. I think that a person's outside life can have an impact on their job performance, but I'll state again that what's important to me is their job performance. And if they're doing their job well and advancing the team effort in the Department of Law and supporting the governor, then that's what's important. But I don't think that somebody's political activities are, while they are absolutely constitutionally protected, I don't think that they're entirely irrelevant to a person's, may not be entirely irrelevant to a person's job performance. And so I will, I can't pledge that I would never look at somebody's partisan activities, nor do I envision myself conducting some sort of witch hunt. As I said before, I'm proud of the Department of Law team, and expect to lead it if confirmed over the remaining months of my service, and that's what's going to be important to me.
And just a great example would be, you know, in my office, what I look for is, you know, good people that work hard, that care about the process, and I don't frankly know. I don't know what party Vanessa's registered as. I don't have a clue.
I have those records, Madam Chair.
But if she were out, for example, donating to my opponent, the very person that was setting out to get my job, and by virtue of that, remove me from the position I was in, it probably would be disconcerting to me. So I think that your answer is complete as it can be, because I think you have to look at those things on an individual basis, and I don't envision you being the kind of individual that's going to go out and do a profile of the politics of all the individuals that work in your office and draw a bright line that says if you're a member of the Green Party or the Democratic Party, then by definition you're fired. That being said, you know, there are activities outside of the workplace that can rise to a level where you're really undermining the entire effort of the office. So, Senator Huggins.
Mr. Marquez, you have to excuse me. I had to go to another conference quickly. But, you know, I admittedly represent a constituency called veterans, and I'm proud of that. And I will go out of my way to make sure that we give them a fair handshake for what they've done for our country. Same goes for those people live in Mat-Su that wear Carhartts, which is the super majority. And, you know, it sometimes concerns me when I see some of the forums here in the legislature where you see some groups, you're a lawyer, and some of them are lawyers that are advocating for, you can see that they're part of the food chain that they're advocating for. That bothers me, the fact that, you know, some of my fellow legislators, people do that. But, you know, that's the practice that they have. But in that line, I ask you, well, let me add one other thing. I see that you, as a former employee in the oil industry, I see that as a strength for us as a state over time. But my question to you, number one, is there anything about your relationship with the oil industry that we should be aware of that makes you uncomfortable as you go forward to be the Attorney General?
No, there isn't anything that makes me uncomfortable. As I've stated, I've spent most of my career litigating and arbitrating against and negotiating with the very parties that I will continue to negotiate with. I don't feel any discomfort, and I think that the people of Alaska ought to be assured that I will vigorously represent their state in those negotiations.
In the sense of your business enterprise investment portfolio, is there anything that this consolidated committee should be aware of in that respect that makes you uncomfortable that could be exposed in the future?
There's no I don't own any interest in any oil company. I don't own any stock in any oil company. My funds are mostly in mutual funds and bonds, and whatever bonds I have, I will make sure that those bonds are not from municipalities or other entities in the state of Alaska, and that my bond manager doesn't purchase any corporate bonds from companies that are doing business in Alaska. That's going to be, or at least that I'll have dealings with it, that might be very hard because we do a lot of business with a lot of companies. But at least I'm going to have him or her not do any corporate bonds with oil industry, any oil industry sector members.
In the respect of follow-up, excuse me, in the respect of conflict of interest, if you in the future in any endeavor in your official capacity saw that there was a potential conflict of interest, do we have your assurance that you will declare that conflict of interest publicly and not practice the conflict?
I've been filing APOC reports since I took the job as legislative liaison a couple of years ago, and I believe those APOC reports are absolutely true and correct. As the governor mentioned when he appointed me, he asked me to have my financial holdings reviewed by my ethics supervisor, who at the time was Barbara Ritchie, and they were reviewed by Paul Lyle, of who is the state ethics attorney, and they did not feel that I have any conflict of interest, and I certainly would pledge to reveal any conflict of interest that might arise in the future. And I'm certainly going to take every step I can to avoid any acquisitions or any actions that might give rise to a conflict of interest in the future.
And finally, Madam Chair, if I might, if we flipped open the moral dictionary on Dave Marcus, is there anything that would be embarrassing for the state or this committee in the future that would come to light?
No.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Grunberg and then Senator Guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Marcus. I understand before I got here this morning that you discussed in your opening statement a bit about your duty to the state versus to the governor personally. I have never been in favor of an elected attorney general because I think that the twin potential conflicts can be ethically resolved, although sometimes not without difficulty. But on the other hand, nobody ever said you have an easy job, the person in your seat. I assume you've thought at some length about potential conflicts there. I'd like you to, just in your own words, describe how you would resolve those conflicts if there were a potential position for the governor personally or politically that some might say is not in the state's best interest or vice versa. Where do you see your role and how would you handle that?
Well, of course, ultimately, the governor is accountable to the people of Alaska. And if the people of Alaska feel that the governor has not been acting in the best interest of Alaska, it's their privilege and duty to not vote for him if he seeks re-election. So I think there's always the most important part of it is the accountability of the people. But my experience, I have been advising executives for most of my career. And what usually happens and what I would expect would continue to happen within the cabinet is that an executive or the governor will propose a course of action The cabinet will weigh in on all sorts of policy grounds, and I'll weigh in on whether the proposed action is legal or illegal or likely legal or illegal, or that there is some risk that it might be legal or illegal. And I think Representative Grunberg, in your experience as a lawyer, there are certainly some actions that are clearly illegal, and it's easy to give that advice. More often, there's a legitimate dispute about whether an action is illegal or legal. My experience and my goal has always been to help an executive. First, I come to an understanding of what the goal of the executive is, and then I try to help the executive reach that goal through legal means and give prompt and clear advice about illegal.
I'm not trying to thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not trying to interrupt you. I don't want to approach the. I don't even want to go to the easy case of whether something's legal or not. I'm talking about a difficult case where no question about whether something is legal, but the question is a value judgment about whether what they're doing not just the legal sense, but in the sense that you, as an attorney, advise a client, a personal client, two legal courses of action, but one that would benefit the corporate body, in this case the state, and one that might benefit the personal person more than the body politic. No question about legality. The difficult case. I want you to envision the difficult case and answer my question based on that hypothetical. Both clearly legal. I want you to approach the ethical issue.
Well, I think that I'd have to give advice that the governor or the executive must act in the best interest of the state and forego any actions that would benefit the individual over the best interest of the state, and I would give that clear advice. Ultimately, I think what any attorney has to do is resign if the actions that are being taken are so clearly unethical or illegal, despite your advice to the contrary. I think ultimately the Attorney General has to resign.
Appreciate that personally and professionally. Appreciate that answer. And through the chair, when your predecessor sat in that seat, it may have been up in Anchorage at a hearing. I'm not sure where it was. We discussed, he and I, as I recall, the question of whether the Attorney General personally, as a unique person in the cabinet, has a duty to avoid even the appearance of an impropriety. What is your position? What is your standard in the job?
I would think that the people of Alaska need to hold me to the highest ethical and moral standards. And I say what I'm going to say next not to take away from that at all. I think that it's very important that the Attorney General, unique among all the cabinet members, be the strong legal advisor of the governor, but also the ethical advisor to the governor. And I think that that's a very important role for the Attorney General. I'm very proud of ARCO that I worked for over 20 years. No longer exists, but one of the things that I was most proud about it was that the then General Counsel of Aniak Richfield Company really believed that the legal department of ARCO was the conscience of the company. And I think that's a very important role for the Chief Legal Officer. It may seem presumptuous, it may seem overblown, but I do think that's an important role for the Attorney General is to have very high standards. I think it can be a slippery slope to say to avoid the appearance of impropriety. I think the Ethics Act talks about substantial impropriety. And the problem with the appearance of impropriety is that that is in the eyes of the beholder, and a political enemy can vow that you appear to be improper when there has been no substantial impropriety. But saying that, I still believe that the Attorney General, more than probably any other cabinet member, ought to be held to very high standards of behavior.
Madam Chair, I appreciate.
And Madam Chair, I was going to ask if Senator Turia wants to come up.
Oh,
there's a seat.
I appreciate that answer, and I don't often feel it is necessary to defend our profession, and I will say it only once. But I think that our profession is the guardian of the ethics of our society, and that is probably one of the reasons people look at us so askance as attorneys when one of our members is not professional and not ethical, because it goes without saying that we must uphold the highest standards. And I appreciate your answer. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I think, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I don't have a question anymore.
All right, any further questions?
No, Madam Chair.
Just, Senator Frank.
I know we're wrapping up, but we haven't given the Attorney General any opportunity to talk about the criminal division, which is a great interest of mine from my background. And I know your experience has been mostly in the civil arena, but you've had some opportunity since you've come on board to work with Ms. Parks and the sentencing bill we passed this year. Maybe you could discuss that experience and how that would assist you in leading a new or leading a group of prosecutors who may be looking to you for leadership.
I take that role very seriously, Senator French, through the chair. As I stated earlier, I was very lucky to have this job as legislative liaison, because it gave me the opportunity to work with lawyers in both divisions. And while I don't have any real criminal law experience in my background, other than in some very isolated areas of environmental law, but I very much enjoyed my opportunity to get to know the dedicated prosecutors in the criminal law division. And while I certainly have not become an expert, in fact, I probably don't have the knowledge that the most raw assistant district attorney has about criminal law and criminal procedure, I do feel that I was able to get a substantial education over the last 2 years as we passed, as the legislature passed with our urging significant criminal legislation and significant sentencing legislation. And I want to thank the legislature very much for advancing both those pieces of legislation, and I enjoyed working with the legislature on both those pieces of legislation. And I also want to thank the legislature for last year adding a number of prosecutors. Our felony referrals had gone up some 60% during the last decade, but we hadn't increased the number of prosecutors. And with the help of the legislature last year, by adding, I think, six prosecutors, we were able to staff offices in Palmer and Kenai and help alleviate the heavy workload of prosecutors. And I hope that the legislature will see fit to fund again this year those additional prosecutors that were approved last year. I think it'll be a very important part of my job to sustain the morale and encourage the professionalism of the criminal division.
Glad you asked that question. Okay, this is going to be unique. On behalf of Senator Seekins, I'll take an at ease so that his Senate committee can come back to continue their meeting today. And on behalf of the joint hearing, I'll adjourn. Thank you, Mr.